Nobody's listening except us
Long
right now.
Talk Radio.
We'll sort of we'll wait for the other people to find their way here.
Great.
How was your day, Tarif?
My day was great. I'm actually in the Rocky Mountains right now, so I'm seeing
gorgeous.
Yeah, so I'm like in a good place.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Who just called in?
Me, Lincoln.
Lincoln!
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
How's it going? Good.
Life's good on my end. Therese in the Rockies, so that's...
Oh, that's awesome. Right? No? Yeah?
I think he'll be winning the game.
A little bit. Like, a little slightly, right?
Yeah. And how was your day, Taylor?
Pretty good. Pretty work-oriented, as it usually is these
days.
Did
you conquer lands? And
I did not conquer any lands. I did write another human rights policy, and this one was a bit trickier because the company is very anti-human rights, so they gave me a run for my money. But,
okay.
You know? It worked itself out.
Now, I'm going to be honest and admit, I don't know what writing human rights policy for a company that doesn't like human rights means. I have no idea what that means.
It's just a terrifying ordeal.
Okay.
It means you can't say superfluous things like we believe in the UN and have that accepted without argument.
Well, hopefully there won't be too much argument tonight. Or maybe there will be a lot of argument.
Maybe. I don't know.
We'll see. Now, do y'all all know each other? I don't know if y'all... I feel like Tarif, maybe you've met Lincoln before. Lincoln, you met Tarif, maybe?
I feel like that's true. Yes. It's been a while. Yes.
Yeah, I think we've definitely met, but I can't really place it. But it's nice to speak to you guys again.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, and you both were like BU folks, and...
Mm-hmm.
Taylor is from Atlanta. I met her in a past life.
Nice. By which he means high school.
Okay.
Just to clarify. Fair enough. So I'm not sure where Day and Evan are, but I do know both of them are out on the left coast, so it might take them a second to get here. But also, I think I decided that I'm not driving this train. Taylor's driving this train today, so.
Yes.
So we can, I mean, you know, we can wait around for them, or we can talk about life, or we can just dive in. I don't know.
I'm down for either one. I mean, I know last week we kind of introduced ourselves as a part of the podcast, so I can wait in terms of hearing about everyone's life, which I am excited to hear about, since I don't know either of you, so it'll be really exciting to get to meet you both, Tarif and Lincoln.
Sure.
We can give them a few more seconds. I mean, time differences always throw me off, so I there's no telling.
Cool. And I'll shoot them some text as well.
Great, I'll so why don't we go ahead, because I know last time when we did this last week, Tarif and Lincoln, we kind of got cut off by the robot lady who just decided that she didn't want to listen to us anymore and just shut the entire conversation down. So we
mm-hmm.
don't want to lose any seconds. We don't want to lose the time we do have because, you know, it may never come back. So,
okay, cool.
Let's just go ahead and dive.
I will say I did add a little bit more time this time just in case.
Oh, great. Because we were having a wonderful kind of wrap-up session and it just... ended the call.
No.
it was interesting. But, okay, so I'm going to switch over to being formal as if we did not have all this bad conversation. Yeah?
You got it.
All right. Cool. So, hello, everyone, and welcome to The Response, which is a group of folks gathering once a week to discuss the state of the world and ask questions and encourage dialogue on social and political issues, maybe some non-social and political issues. My name is Taylor, and I'm going to be the facilitator for the call this week. And we've also got with us Therese, Lincoln, and Demarius. We may or may not have two more people joining us, but in the meantime, we'll go ahead and get started. So every week we start, we'll try to start by having everyone introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about themselves, where they are, and then talk about one interesting headline that was in the news or something that interested them this week. So Therese, do you want to start?
Good thing. Hi, everyone. I'm Therese. I live in Boston. I work at a tech company as a programmer. I am very much focused on, in terms of headlines, the Vault 7 leak that came out this week with WikiLeaks and all the information about the CIA. So, you know, I'm sure everyone's probably heard something or another about that. I find it fascinating, if not unsurprising. So that's just a little bit about me.
Great. And Lincoln?
Sure. So I'm Lincoln. I am a grad student. I'm a doc student in counseling psych program in Chicago, and do some clinical work and all that fun stuff as well, with like research and clinical and just general interest in Black college student development. What else? Yeah. So as far as this week, things that I've been interested in is a lot of the commentary on the movie Get Out and what that says about the Black experience. Even me, like, seeing it and what it was like seeing the movie in, like, a predominantly white suburb and that whole experience and that anxiety mixed with the movie. So that's what I've been interested in this week. Yeah.
And Demarius, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'll also say I think Evan's on the call, too.
Oh,
here
hi,
I am.
Evan.
I'm here. Hello. I've been listening silently. I hopped on a minute ago.
I'm Demarius. I'm in D.C., currently banging my head against bureaucratic systems, and it hurts. It hurts in a lot of ways. And I guess the story I'm just fascinated by, and it's a part of, I guess, what I want to get at today, is, you know, still the story about Trump just making up wiretapping claims. I just am fascinated by it. I just can't.
And Evan, just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're situated, what you do, and one headline that's interested you this week.
Sure. My name's Evan. I am living in Los Angeles. I work at a movie television studio. I've been focusing mostly this week, headline-wise, on just the local Los Angeles city elections, trying to stay local. Elect the city officials that I agree with. So there was one particular measure that was the most kind of heated one in our city this week, and it was about whether to completely halt any housing developments for the next 2 years or not, so as to you know, with the intention, if that were to be voted yes on, with the intention to kind of reorganize how developments are done in LA in general. Unfortunately, there would be a huge downside to halting housing developments for 2 years all across the board. It would create skyrocketing prices for any housing, and it would push people further into poverty. So I voted no on that one, but that's what I've been focusing on.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and I'm Taylor. I live in New York. I think I just realized all of us are in different cities, so this is actually even more exciting. I am a human rights consultant, and this is technically an old headline, but I've been really still interested in the Flint water crisis, and how maybe a week after Trump was elected, the investigation into how the situation came to be was halted, and it came back up in a news article this week, and I just realized that it's been maybe 3 years since they've had clean water, and it's kind of gotten lost in news cycles for a while now, and trying to figure out a way I can kind of bring that conversation back up and what non-political ways we can kind of solve it. So great. It's great to have everyone on the call. And we'll get right down to business. So Demarius has us all here today to discuss a question. And it is, in the battle to come, what must be held sacred and what must be allowed to be profaned? And he prefaced this by saying, he was thinking about the question in terms of how ideology becomes infused with religious fervor and how that fervor factors into political strategy. So we'll start from there. The group is generally oriented in asking questions to Demarius to kind of understand more about what brought him to ask this question and how we can, as a group, help him solve any sort of conflicts he may be having about how to answer it himself. So I would give the floor to, you know, the group to ask any burning questions. If anyone has anything that they think will, you know, start the conversation off, feel free to have at it. Or I can also ask a question, but I'll give a moment of uncomfortable silence.
I have a question I think we can kick off with. It might be, I give the preface that it's kind of like jumping into the deep end of the pool, but it is a question. And that question is anyone on this call feel like they agree with the social justice angle of the paradigm, the article that Demarius had us read, the one telos truth or social justice? Does anyone fall on the social justice end of that spectrum?
I mean, and I guess a way to preface too would be if to see whether or not people got a chance to get to it, because some people probably didn't, which is fair. I barely did, and I sent it out.
That article, DJ, that was a really good, I think, comparison of the two, of the kind of dilemma people in the university are facing. If you recap that article, like, to kick us off.
And I might not do it justice. But a part of why I guess I sent that off, because this point about universities being oriented towards either truth and truth seeking or social justice and changing the world, and all the different ways in which that plays itself out on campus. And it flows all the way into what, you know, things we know about safe spaces or, you know, policing. Speech policing is sort of what they talk about. So the article, there's a lot of stuff in there, and particularly I pull out this term sacredness out of that lecture, because I guess the interest in terms of individuals who are particularly concerned with social justice rallying around certain ideas, certain concepts, certain notions, words, phrases as sacred and others as profane, and sort of enforcing that with this fervor. And the Jonathan Haidt argues that basically these things clash, and at some point one of them has to give. And he is sort of in this place where he believes that this shift that's taking place at the end of the 20th century, now into the 21st century, to this telos of social justice, he thinks is problematic in a university setting, but he also just says that he thinks universities have to decide what they're doing and being clear about that, and then you allow people to sort it out that way. Did I leave something out of that piece, Tarif?
No, I think that's a pretty good way of capturing what that piece was about.
And so, I mean, for me to answer your question about social justice, at the very least, I know I'm a person concerned, or at least I think I am concerned with social justice issues and the attempt to construct a more just world and a more equitable world. I would say that. But in a part of why I present this question today is that I struggle with, I'm also a person centrally concerned with truth. Like inner philosopher, and I do see places where the search or the attempt to get to bring about a more just society might clash with truth.
Tarif, I would almost want to throw your question back at you, because the way it was phrased and saying, is anyone in the group social justice, does that mean that you are truth? And if so, can you defend it?
Sure, yeah. So I posed that question within the paradigm of the article, saying that the university system has to choose one. And I was wondering if folks fell on that side, because for me, the university is a place which was always about knowledge and the pursuit of truth and rational thinking, and not about an agenda, which to me, social justice is an agenda. I don't think it's a bad agenda necessarily. I think a lot of the fights that are going on are good, but I would rather, you know, the basis of our intellectual spirit be based on the pursuit of truth, not necessarily justice. I think justice is a lot more ambiguous. Does that make sense? The reason why I posed that question.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Does anyone else have any thoughts before I throw a thought out?
Yeah, well, just asking then, so what exactly is truth? And I guess if we're comparing it to social justice, which is more ambiguous, then truth would be more unambiguous. So what would make it more unambiguous if we're looking at it that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think
sure.
A part of one of the things that I wrestle with as a sort of person who thinks I'm a philosopher searching for truth is, how do you know when you get there and what does that mean? But I think mostly it's a directional aim sort of piece. All right. And so ultimately, where are you aiming and what are you aiming for? And ultimately, to get to some sort of objective reality that is verifiable, which we recognize is very like quite difficult in what that means. But ultimately, the work in an academic setting or in some sort of intellectual setting, the work is to be about uncovering what is true, undeniable, or somehow provable. And there are some interesting notions, too, in the excerpt from The Politics of Small Things, and where sort of this distinction that Hannah Arendt makes between factual truth and philosophical truth, right? And these sort of higher ideals, right, which are more ideological, right? So it is true that all people are created equal, right? Sort of this lofty philosophical sort of statement. But then it's also, it is true that factually true that people of different races are treated differently by the criminal justice system in this country, more specifically in Washington, D.C., where I currently find myself. And that's the distinction she'd make.
It's interesting in your example, Damaris, that you say all people are created equal as being a philosophical truth.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna this is Evan, sorry. I was just gonna say, like, because I didn't read the articles, unfortunately. I wanted to, but I ended up, I'm still at work right now in my boss's office, so I'm just, you know, here's where I am.
Respect
but,
for the hustle. Respect.
I made it on the call. But I guess when I keep trying to think of these concepts of social justice and truth and whatever, I think the first thing that came to mind was, you know, like, the idea, one of the most common social justice kind of, you know, ideas that everyone is, you know, equal. It's like this egalitarian kind of perspective. And then I kind of think of like, well, is that the social justice angle? Then the angle of truth would be kind of more, less ambiguous and kind of digging into what that equality is and how people are created equal and what that, is that what we're talking about? Or is that like the distinction that we're trying to make here? Or is that completely off base?
I throw that question back out. I'm not sure. But and I guess my argument, my example probably was a little bit flippant, but I do think it's about what, and I know this is a dangerous term, but what could be a universal claim, right? And a part of that philosophical truth that ultimately that is a universal claim cannot be on some level empirically proven, but it can be pointed to. And so maybe a better statement would be like all people are deserving of inherent dignity, or there is an inherent dignity in the lived of living beings. That might get out of what you're talking about, but I don't know. Does that respond to what you're saying, Evan?
Somewhat, yeah, enough.
Feel free to push me further because I don't know. Feel free.
Well, I think perhaps what Lincoln is getting at is if we don't have and you say universal claim, and that's the term I'll go with for now, is if we don't have a universal claim as to what truth means, then we can't have Therese's conversation about whether or not we prefer social justice to truth. Granted, I would say I exist further along that spectrum in believing that social justice is truth, but I don't think we're that far along in the conversation yet to talk about that. But I guess in my attempt to try to tie everyone together to find some sort of thing we can all agree on, it would be without a definition of truth, we can't build on it, right? Or at least that's what, you know, R is telling us, is that if we don't establish this fact that there are different kinds of truth and talk about the parameters of the truth we're talking about, we can't have deeper conversations. So, I mean, we can take what Arndt says and say, what type of truth do we think of in the context of social justice? Or maybe I put that the wrong way. In what world does social justice exist? What truth world does social justice fit into?
I like that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it factual? Is it philosophical? Is it something else that, you know, someone else didn't bring up in some of the readings?
I think perhaps one of the I guess an example, I'm just thinking out in terms of the headlines recently and the attempted repeal or replacement or whatever they're doing when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, I like to, every morning I like to, you know, read Fox News and then also Huffington Post, and then I think it helps me get to the center. And one of the post on, you know, screaming headlines in Huffington Post was about how the congressman Jason Chavitz, I think, made this sort of flippant comment about, well, like, poor people need to stop buying iPhones, you know, they have like healthcare, you know. And here I think is where it becomes like fundamentally important to be like, okay, let's focus on truth claims. And I think a part of what Jonathan Haidt is arguing is that if we are centrally concerned with social justice, then the way that we respond to what he's saying is like, well, you lack understanding and you're ignorant and you're cruel. Right. And it just doesn't make sense. But I think on some level, if we're dealing in truth, then the response is different. It's like, well, first of all, just factually the cost, if we just do a basic, if we do something very basic with math and arithmetic, we get that what you're saying is ridiculous. But also, if we are reaching for its truth more deeply, and this might get to be dangerous territory, there is a statement that he is making about the priorities of people in certain circumstances that might have some truth in it if we were able to dig deep down into there. Right. So then that would be the factual piece about like, well, you're just wrong on the numbers. But then there's also maybe a deeper philosophical piece that he's attempting to and that he's operating off of. But we never get to the level of that discussion if our telos is social justice, because we don't even acknowledge that it's there.
Hmm. So are you saying, and this is me trying to summarize, so there's truth in context and there's truth out of context. So if we're to take the iPhone healthcare example, truth in context would say in America you cannot live, you should not be forced to make the decision between an iPhone or health insurance. But truth out of context would say if you know what your income is, your annual income, and you know that you can only afford one or the other, you should make the informed decision to choose healthcare.
Yeah.
But we know truthfully and factually that iPhone and healthcare, they're not comparable when it comes to that. So I guess that's what I struggle with, because it sounds like the truth could also be that homie is a bigot. And I think like us trying to look for something a little bit deeper of like, well, we could be talking about like the real truth under this outside of a different context, but we know that's not what's going on. So that's something I kind of wrestle with, of like, we kind of act like we're talking about truth and facts and kind of logic, but really when it's centered around bigotry, we know that it's irrational. It's not about logic or truth. It's about like protecting assets and privilege. And I know I'm sounding like a social justice warrior, but that's like what my field is. So, you know,
well, I think the issue is when in the fight for a just cause, people make up facts or they promote false facts to make their argument. And then the whole foundation of the pursuit of this justice is weakened because it's built on these false notions that don't reflect reality. And for me, I do see a lot of that on the social justice side. I see a lot of conflating the situation to make people feel like victims and make them seem more oppressed than they actually are. And I mean, like, mental slavery is a real thing, and I think the social justice end of the spectrum suffers a lot from it.
You want to give us a few examples? Or maybe one or two examples of that, either in recent experience?
I mean, there's a statistic. We'll use like rape culture for an example. There's a statistic of 1 in 4 girls are raped in college campuses based on a study that considered drunk sex to be rape. And now that statistic, you can't even question that correctly. It's like one of the foundational pieces of this rape culture argument. And that's just one example. I think there's a lot of conflating of facts and then definitely a huge amount of victimhood mentality, where every time something happens, it's a message of oppression, when I think there's far more stories of people overcoming obstacles, and that should be the focus instead of promoting, I don't know, victimhood. I don't really agree with that aspect of fighting for justice. I don't think you need to be a victim to fight for justice. Some of the strongest people are those who overcome injustices, and they become an example for others. So to me, the whole flavor of the social justice argument and the fact that it uses false facts and statistics in some cases and ignores issues on their own side, it just doesn't make for a strong argument.
Well, okay. Let's slow down for a sec. I think... because I want to contextualize, at least the very least, the question I'm bringing is that there are a lot of, and this is the piece about the sacred and the profane that I'm interested in, right, is how do we engage in a political strategy? Because once again, let's center what this podcast is about. It's about political strategies. How do we engage in a political strategy that ultimately achieves the ends that we are looking for in a way that I guess allows us to be clear about what can't be touched and what can be touched. So, I mean, I think, Tarif, you name a couple of things that are untouchables in a sort of a social justice sort of, you know, pantheon, or for me, and if you can see the image that I put along with this question, it's a bunch of burning temples, Because I think currently what we have is like almost this image of like the Romans are coming in and they're burning the temples, or, you know, and we got to decide which ones to defend. And so some of those things like bigotry, or some of those things like victim blaming, and some of those things like rape culture, and some, all of that, those, you know, you can imagine as sort of their own little temples. On some level, and ultimately the question becomes, what's the world we're attempting to create? And then how do we best get there? And are our attempts to defend certain concepts, ideas, ultimately getting in the way of our creating a better world and actually defending the people? So I say all that just to contextualize before whatever is about to happen happens. What I'm interested here when I talk about sacred and profane. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I assume there are thoughts about what Tarif had to say.
I have a thought, but you know, it's not about the latter half of the comments. It's actually about one of the initial statements is in that you said the study itself was based off of some statistic about drunken sex, which is interesting because I think that actually hits at what we're talking about here. Is if you accept that fact as truth, then the rest of your argument follows logically. But without that fact, without it being centered on that fact, if that study had come to a different conclusion that made the logic of your argument, you know, if it changed the logic of your argument, it would change your opinion of how we treat that topic. So perhaps the question is how fluid, I mean, it's kind of what Damaris is saying. How fluid is truth, and to what extent do we allow that fluidity to determine politics, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, like, for that instance, I think it's a great example, because I do think that I disagree with anything that says drunken sex equals rape. So for me, that argument is completely baseless, and I could never see that as truth. But if, as you were suggesting, that somebody accepts that as truth, then yes, of course, the logic follows. But my issue is, I think for such a touchy kind of issue, the narrative is automatically assuming one side, when I think that many people aren't necessarily going to be on that page, but they don't even have a choice.
I feel like I've been talking a lot, so I'll let the silence ruminate for a few more seconds.
I think the difficulty of having this conversation is a part of what I'm interested in. Right. So, I mean, it would be fair to say that I think probably on this call and in our group of people that we've sort of gathered, there would be different opinions about this piece. Right. But if we start at the viewpoint, for instance, so, and this is, I guess, particularly to you, Tarif, right, because we have conversations and we've had the opportunity to engage about this piece before. At the very least, this idea about truth and social justice. If we can acknowledge that we start from the standpoint that rape is bad, right, and that an idea, a goal that we have in terms of a political goal, is creating a society where rape, A, doesn't happen. All right, that might be too idealistic. So we say B, rape maybe happens a lot less, right? And then C, when rape does happen, it's handled with the proper care, right? And so if we're attempting to get to that world where we can acknowledge, okay, there are people who are victimized, and how are those people who are victimized treated by the system? And we want to alter that system to ensure they're treated in a way that ensures that they have dignity, right? And that perpetrators don't just go off because of whatever, you know, privilege they might have, right? If we want to do that, do we need to sacrifice the discomfort or the ways we go about having the conversation in the first place in order to get to that end? But we, at the very least, I think, have to start with the acknowledgement and make sure we're all on the same page. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense. Maybe I'm still processing a little bit, but are you essentially saying can we be politically correct in these conversations?
I mean, that's a part of it, right? But here's the difficulty, and I asked, you know, for Evan and Lincoln, I asked for help because I'm sincerely struggling in the sense of how do we get to a better world if we can't drive through the conversation in the first place? And I mean, the reality is that we all get caught up in the language sometimes, and then the language we ascribe intentions, and then we get tripped up, and then we don't end up on the other side where we've actually pieced together a political strategy that actually solves the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you're not asking an easy question.
I mean, we can always attempt to do that here, right? So to be fair, I would say questions about rape are inherently difficult because they play on a lot of different social issues, right? We're talking about just gender, we're talking about equality, we're talking about a lot of different things here at once. But if we are truly here to foster dialogue, then this would be a great place to try to do what you're talking about, Demarius, right? And whether or not we're successful or not, it's not necessarily the point, but it is the point to see if we can have the conversation. So if I say, Therese, I think your logic is really flawed here because, you know, of XYZ reason, I will give those reasons. But, you know, we have to be comfortable having those conversations. Is it possible? And if everyone in the group is able to do it, why not take the most uncomfortable situation I can think of, frankly, at this point in time, it being International Women's Day, no less.
Yeah.
To have the conversation. But, you know, it's worth, why not give it a shot if everyone's comfortable?
I think that's where I raised my hand up, and I'm like, no. And I think the fact that that's kind of where we landed with this on International Women's Day, and the fact that it's kind of framed in this like intellectual way, where we're talking a lot about like words and what they mean, and kind of just looking at this very serious and personal kind of issue when it comes to assault, and we're kind of framing it in kind of this intellectual way. I don't want to have that conversation. But if you all do, then that's fine. But I would probably want to excuse myself just because I don't think I would be able to have it the way I'd want to. And I don't know everybody in this conversation as well. So if I'm just being honest and transparent with that, that's where I am with it.
Sure. I mean, is there another example where we can essentially play on Demarius's idea here that we have to be willing to break through some sort of ideological barrier to have conversations that can propel us forward in political strategy? Any other ideas?
Well, really quickly, I mean, because I feel you, Lincoln. A legitimate question I have, and I don't know the answer, is
sure.
How do we engage? Right, because that's a part of what I'm very interested. How do we engage on such an issue?
I guess for me, and this is, I don't know. That's a big question to just kind of come up with an answer to. But I guess for me, I think what my pushback is kind of with it coming across very intellectual, just kind of an intellectual conversation around something
personal.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the problem across the whole world when we get kind of caught up in these conversations about rape, and especially like campus rape culture, that's where we get stuck. And there's this huge divide and voices get lost and all kinds of things. I think like the work I do is a lot of advocacy work. So the role I usually play in these conversations is a bit different. And I don't like being in a kind of headspace when it comes to these types of conversations, if that makes sense. Because I think like experiences can kind of get trivialized. So yeah, that's what's coming up for me right now.
Okay.
I heard another voice in the background there.
Well, no, I was gonna say I totally respect that what you're saying. This is Evan. I totally respect that. I totally, you know, I'm just gonna back away from this being specifically about rape or anything and just kind of talk to the point that you just made, which is, you know, the intellectualizing personal experiences, that kind of thing. And just kind of talk about that more generally instead of talking about the actual personal part of it.
Sure.
Because that's something I struggle with. And I think honestly, I've seen on Facebook and stuff, I kind of see a lot of, you know, and on social media in general, I kind of see, you know, a lot of what people post about in terms of social justice is like, you know, they come from very personal places, and then a lot of the people who criticize them tend to be intellectual. You know, they try to, you know, disprove these kind of, not disprove, but kind of like, you know, almost like fact check sort of these kind of experiences.
Right.
They try and, which is kind of the heart, and I don't know, I didn't read the articles, but it's kind of the heart of what this conversation for me, it's kind of like what I've been trying to figure out is like, how do you legitimately, you know, like when you're trying to make a moral claim about how a certain issue should be resolved, you know, like, and that could be any number of issues that, you know, social justice tackles nowadays. How do you do that in a way that, you know, respects the experience, the personal experience of whoever is claiming, you know, their injustice in a way that, to what, you know, DJ has spoken about, in a way that, you know, is respectful but also respects the proper, I'm trying to find the word, the proper, like, the proper questions that need to be asked in order to reach that end goal, the proper investigation, the proper, like, you know, methods of truth finding, you know, like, and it's not a question I have an answer to, but it just, that's what I find whenever I'm kind of, you know, I'm looking at people discussing their personal experiences and saying, you know, this is wrong, and this happened to me, and I shouldn't have to explain why it's wrong, and, you know, this is something that, you know, I don't want to have to intellectualize. It's just like, I totally get that, but I also don't know how to go from there because it's such a subjective experience. It's hard to even do anything with it. It's hard to move anywhere that could possibly say this is what's wrong with what happened to you in a way that's, as DJ kind of pointed to earlier in this conversation, like, objective. Does that make sense, or did I just blur a bunch of words there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And words made sense.
I'm just gonna put it out there. I think words matter very much, and they dictate narratives. They pretty much define what we what something means. So for me, words are important. And intellectualism is a good thing. It's the ability to think critically about an issue in the face of an emotionally traumatizing event is something to be respected, not the deference to emotion in the face of an important decision, especially decisions that will eventually lead to social engineering. I mean, to me, social engineering in general is just a crazy concept, but then to have that be driven purely on a perception of injustice, and that's not to take away real injustices, but we also can't ignore the fact that one person's mistreatment is a systemic oppression, and to somebody else, it's just a bad day, and they move on. So, to me, that's mm-hmm. just it's not a very strong foundation to build a society off of. I don't like what I hear when I hear people say that. It scares me.
I have a question based on that. Is what is, and I now that I framed the question in my mind, I realize that this is perhaps subjective. I'm not sure. Is what is the difference between perceived injustice and actual injustice? Because I think what we've all kind of, what this conversation has forced us to see is that the self is capable of making judgments that are strictly personal, and we somehow have to adapt those perspectives to all of society, right? Or at the very least communicate them in ways that acknowledge that we all have the ability to have personal beliefs, but also that we are a part of a larger society, right? So if a person says there's a difference between perceived injustice and injustice, that is also a personal ideology, right? So that is also one version of truth. Like, that's a personal truth. And I guess I'm throwing that at Demarius specifically because this is kind of your question.
I'd say, I guess like 12 steps back, one of the things that I assert, which I recognize is not true for our culture in general and also for our generation, right, is that I believe that truth does exist, right? So I do believe that there is, that reality is greater than just the sum of our perceptions of reality, right? And so for me, there is this constant drive towards, all right, what is, right? And then also that connecting with higher level truth, what ought to be, right? So for me, I think on those levels. So there, and I don't know what this process looks like. So I feel like there needs to be a process by which you are, I'm thinking of, there's a philosopher, Iris Murdoch, that talks about the need for a process that reorients the naturally sort of selfish or self-involved sort of human psyche that always is going to on some level turn in on itself, right? And then feed into its perceptions of the world and then respond based on those perceptions, right? And a part of the work that's constantly, I think, we're all involved in, and I could be so wrong in psychology, so once again, Lincoln, I'd ask for your help, right? But the work that we are involved in terms of maturation, in terms of living inside of a society or a community with other people, is figuring out, okay, greater, there is a greater perspective than my own, yeah? But also, my perspective matters. And there is that tension, right? I'm thinking of Thurman, universal particular, right? Tension. And we don't, and we're in a place where it's we got to find, you know, Aristotle's golden mean. He says it's like a pendulum, right? And so for so long, particularly in a society like ours, it has been dominated by this understanding, like ideas of truth and what is reality have been a very particular group, very particular class, very particular gender, very particular segment of the population of people utilizing such claims to dominate masses of individuals, right? And they were able to do that, so we had the pendulum swung so far over there, right, where people's individual perspectives did not matter, particularly the perspectives of particular groups of people. So I think a part of what I see is that we are, I don't know if we're in the process or we've already swung back over. I think we might have swung back over in the pendulum to the other side, hardcore on the other side, right? If you look at statistics of about the number of Americans who think that truth is real, like truth is a thing, right? I think it's somewhere in the 30s, right? Which is like really difficult to maintain a society if everybody's operating on their own truth. And nobody's attempting to get at something greater. So I guess I'm interested in a process that reorients a personal process that reorients the selfish spirit, but then also a structural or social process that allows for the speaking of certain perspectives into the space in a way that then transforms policy. So something that, you know, I don't know if any of that makes sense. That might have just been words. I could try again, but I don't think it'd come out any better.
I don't think it's no, your description was great. I just don't know if we'll get there. I don't have faith that we will. And what I'm referring to is getting to that greater sense of truth. You know, whether it's the long-term effects of postmodernism on our culture, or at least intellectually, I don't know if people in America or even just the West are prepared to seek a greater truth. Not until a whole lot of fighting has to be done first.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. A part of the journey towards truth, even though, you know, I termed truth objective, right? A part of the journey towards that piece has to be through the individual, right? So through the individual and through the individual's experience.
Right. And
truth is found there too.
I think, yeah, you're right that the individual plays an important role. And that's the scariest part, is that the individual is so often excused of their rational thinking. We encourage people not to have critical thinking skills, and then they're such a foundational part of achieving this greater sense of truth. We don't even have the tools to do that. We prefer, as a species, I think, to go by our gut feelings, our emotions, our propensity to go and want to be on a team, as opposed to rationally looking at the data that we've collected and making a sound decision based on that.
But where's the space in this now? And this is what I'm struggling with. Where's the space in for emotion, irrational experience, right? So things that can't necessarily be easily quantified, right? In the picture that you're building, in terms of assessing truth, and once again, ground this in the understanding that I think we are engaged in a larger societal battle where rights and lives will be lost and won. Right? Like there will be, I don't take this conversation lightly. So I want to just note that I don't think this conversation exists in a vacuum. It exists in a place where there are camps and walls built, and there are doors being shut, and there are people not eating, right? And there are wars being teed up for. So I am, I don't know. I mean, so I guess I mean, I pose that to you, and I pose that to anybody. I mean, how do you inject personal experience, emotion, individual perspective inside of this conversation with truth? But still be yielding towards something greater than just the self.
I think it has a lot to do with whether or not people can step outside of themselves enough to know that somebody is probably sharing their experience, right? So if the idea is that there's strength in numbers, much to our demise, but also maybe to our to, I don't know, maybe to help us in the future, is that there are people who share experiences that have been through similar events in life where, because they have that shared experience, they add that narrative to the conversation. I think the more of those people you find, the more you work together to build your narrative, and you're better able to communicate that narrative in a way that can interact with other narratives. So even here in this group, I think there are six different narratives. All of them are grounded in personal experiences, but there should be a want or desire in all of us to find a common ground from which to discuss the differences in our perspectives without causing problems like they have on a large scale, like they have in our country. So I don't need to know who everyone voted in the previous election to know that we all have a foundational understanding of, you know, being in a group together and having a dialogue about our ideas. Like, I don't need to know anything about your background to have that conversation. To be fair, I've only met one person face-to-face in the entire conversation that has not barred us from having a conversation, which is a positive and important thing that does not happen on a large scale in this country, and I think it's often taken for granted. And maybe that was just me ranting or, like, just getting thoughts out there, but without the kind of openness to speak for yourself, I don't necessarily think you go any further than that. Whether or not we respect one another once someone has spoken their perspective is what I think we're actually dealing with, is that people are more than happy to allow people to, no, people are more than happy to voice their own opinion, but they're not at all prepared to handle when someone does not share that opinion. And how that affects how people can communicate and how they create or build truth is then jeopardized forward.
And I'm sorry for cutting you off, but
go ahead.
I think a part of, and maybe this is what I'm picking up from what Lincoln was saying, it's also a level of, so not just sharing of people's opinions, but people sharing their experiences, and then how you take that information and that experience, what do you do with that? You know, it's just, you know, so there, you know, there, and I think I communicated this with you, Taylor, that a part of my hope for these conversations was me taking a lot of the experiences I've had in terms of these, like, spiritual circles, right? And this spiritual discernment work, and this sort of connecting genuinely with people work, and then taking this and putting this and sort of applying some of those ideas into the political realm, so that we can then produce what's necessary to get us over or through this winter we're going into. So I'm. Yeah, you're right in terms of the political piece, but does that still leave us high and dry, or does that still leave the people bringing their experiences, their traumas, their to the table, and then being dealt with? And I don't know if dealt with is the word, honored appropriately, and then that doesn't sound good, but I guess to say, channeled as well into a force that then stops the oppression or injustices that produce the trauma and some of those lived experiences themselves. A part of the second reading about the politics of small things, the idea is that interesting. A part of that issue is that experience. I guess the interpersonal relationship is where politics and power is actualized, is a part of what it's arguing. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how to connect those interpersonal experiences and how people treat truth and other people's experiences in those conversations, and then replicating that in mass to counter what is an oppressive authority or what might be an oppressive authority. I'm going to stop talking now. Well, I think we did get to 11 p.m., so.
That's very true.
We can call time on that.
Yeah, we can always, if it's a little, if we've complexified, if that's a word I can use, the conversation a little bit too much for an hour, we can always end here. If anyone had a response to DJ or any lingering thoughts.
Maybe not a direct response, but just like a summarizing thought that maybe would be good to get out there. Your question originally, what must be held sacred? And I think, if anything, I think truth and that pursuit of a greater objective reality should be held sacred. And I guess that's where that's what I'd like to end on, for me at least.
Anything else? I will say one of the article about particularly just the, I think it's, I'm trying to find the exact quote. Oh, it's not my job to educate you. Was a line that apparently some progressive activists have been using either online or, you know, in their communications with people they disagree with. And that was interesting to me in that it was a group of people hoping to have a conversation about social justice being unwilling to communicate their ideologies to others, which seemed a little bit counterproductive. And it was just something that was very enlightening to me about if I sound like one of those liberals and whether or not I need to change my attitude towards people I disagree with or hold a different truth from. It was interesting.
Yeah, and a part of the work, I don't know, and I'm in the place of reading a lot of King right now just because of the program I'm in, and we're reading them in conversation with Bonhoeffer, and there's this piece about it is extraordinarily exhausting, right? Which is a reality. It is exhausting to constantly attempt to pull people out of their ignorance, right? Because sometimes it's pulling people out of their ignorance. Sometimes I think it's some other work, but a lot it's exhausting, right? So I get it, right? I get it's not my job to educate you right now, right? That makes sense to me. But then also, I don't know, the phrase I sort of think about is like if you build a dam and the dam breaks, you can't like get pissed off at the water, right? Like it is there the water, or I mean a canal system would probably be a better example, but the water is flowing in a particular way, it's going to do what it's going to do, right? And so if I'm a person who looks at the system and I say the system is unjust and I need to change that, then on some level I do take on this burden of, all right, I got to change it. And particularly if we look at Goldfarb's work in The Politics of Small Things, that work takes place on the micro level in the daily human interactions and how people carry the oppressive or unjust system with them in their minds and actualize it in their actions, in their words. And so I'm constantly sort of having to do that, and like that's okay, I guess, because that ultimately is the work until we get to a more just world. And then occasionally we create spaces where we can relax, and this is a part of the safe space piece, but it's more or less, for me, it's more like creating spaces where you can engage with people and like a relaxed, and you don't also ultimately have to be on alert and constantly, you know, letting people mm-hmm. know what's real, so that you can refuel, because you got to go back out in the world and be engaged in the work of pulling people in, but you also have to do that in such a way that and this is, I think, really sucks, that you put down or distance yourself from some of the emotional hurt that will come along with that hurt, with that work.
Sure.
And I acknowledge that that work is not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So should we...
I like that as an ending point, because I think that's the that's the hard part.
All right.
Emotions are hard. I think that was the conclusion.
Emotions are hard. Emotions are hard. Experiences are hard. I mean, but we got to figure out a way. And I think it's quite possible that a part of our difficulty is that maybe there aren't ways to do this effectively yet, or it's more likely that I haven't found them. which is probably the case, which is why, like, I reach out and try to include, like, smart people and engage in a conversation with people who have done things and know things. Because this conversation is hard. So I don't know. Are there any thoughts about how we can better do this? Refunds, reflections on the conversation. Thank you, Taylor, for taking on this task. It's not an easy task, right?
It's not an easy task. It's terrifying, especially when you found out the day before.
Exactly. I appreciate you stepping up. Yeah. I do.
Thoughts on the conversation. I think, as always, it helps when the readings are very good. It gives us a lot to work with. So that's good. Actually, I'm going to have to... The politics of small things is a lot thicker contextually than I was prepared for. And I was on the train thinking that this was just going to be like a easy breezy reading, and it was not. And I was excited about it, but also ran out of time on the train. That's how complex it was, that I was not on the train long enough to finish it. Perhaps, and you know, maybe we, just as a group, we'll have to have a longer conversation about what can and cannot be discussed. I think part of the original hope was that there were, that this would be a, that we could use these as an opportunity to speak openly, but I think in respect of Lincoln's thoughts early in the conversation as something that just hasn't hit me personally yet, and I'm sure that there will be topics that do that for me personally, is that we need to have some sort of protocol for that in place. I don't want that to happen again, frankly. So perhaps figuring out what those issues are and making sure we handle them appropriately as a group.
Lincoln, are you still on the call?
Who else is on the phone?
I am. I'm over here. Okay. Hi.
Hey.
Could you offer some thoughts or guidance?
Sure. Just around that. I don't know. I think obviously, like, you don't know until things come up. It's just I don't want to trivialize something that is so personally and emotionally triggering for people. And just like a subject in general like that. I think you have to just have kind of, I don't know if it's boundaries, but just approach it very carefully. Like, it's not just like an intellectual conversation. There's more to that. So like, how do we approach having those conversations in a way, like understanding that certain things are going to touch people differently. And there's nothing wrong with that or a judgment around it, but just something that we can think about. And I can definitely think about too. Just how we can kind of think about what we'll do to manage that in the future, like you said. So
I'm going to take responsibility for that one, because when I asked for examples, I frankly wasn't thinking that was going to be the example that was given. Otherwise I would have obviously never asked the question. Frankly, I would have never done that. That was on me for not thinking of where that could have gone.
And here's the thing too that I'm interested in. So for me, I want the conversation to be a space where, like I said, a part of the idea is people learning two things. One, how do we listen? How do we maintain a curiosity about each other and about each other's thoughts, like a sincere curiosity. And also, how do we, because I do think truth is a thing, so how do we look at this? And ultimately, because I am, I mean, and I don't say this lightly, I am sincerely concerned about where we are. I think it's like, it's actually pretty scary where we are. And I do think in order to get to, at the very least, an effective political strategy, because I'm looking now, I don't see one, right? And I've talked to Luke after our podcast last week about this or piece. But like, I don't see it in like that, you know, Indivisible, for instance, that piece. I don't see the effective political strategy that's going to counter what is about to come. And so a part of what I'm interested in is, how do you bridge this gap that is real, right, between, for instance, Lincoln and Tarif? Because there's a gap that's real, you know, and I don't think it, and a part of it is, I mean, a part of it is just that's there. But a part of it is a production of, I don't know, our systems and how our systems have sort of taught us how to interact and how to engage. And I think we can find a way to get over it, because if we do, that's how we confront it. But there's a there's a reason why we're having the difficulty in the first place. Right? Well, and well, I don't think it's, you know, my mistake.
I think you should be scared. I think that's a very rational thought and feeling to have. Because
no,
I'm
not scared because I believe in Jesus. So ultimately, I know how it ends. But I'm just
All right then.
Because part of the reason we lost, and I say we meaning probably anybody who feels slightly afraid of the administration that we have and some of the goons that they've put in power, the reason that happened in November, I think, can be traced to a denial of some of the stuff we've talked about, which is truth and kind of that pursuit and focus of emotion and people's experiences. So you should be concerned, because there's a large amount of people that value that more than, you know, necessarily the intellectual side, as we've seen from this conversation. And if you're trying to bridge, I don't even know if you need to worry about it that way. I think there are two sides of, you know, an approach where you need both. You need those people who are going to value the individual experience. And you also need somebody like me who doesn't care as much about that, because I'm trying to see if there's a more rational or statistics-driven reason to make the same argument. The end goal, I think, is the same, right? Nobody likes a rape culture. Nobody likes bigotry. Nobody likes racism. And so if we
I don't know if you're right.
All right.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
They wouldn't exist.
Well, but in terms of truth, I don't know, and I say this sincerely, because you know I'm a Platonist. I believe in truth, so I'm with you on this piece. But I don't know if you can just throw away a whole section of both how people engage and how people feel, but also like a whole section of human experience, right? I love Thurman tells us that we need to be apostles of sensitiveness and aware of the possibilities of life at all levels of experience, right? So I don't know if a solution to the problem or a strategy that is produced only on one or two levels of experience will actually be able, would be large enough or effective enough, right, to actually produce what we're talking about in terms of effective political strategy to counter what's going on. That's a part of my piece.
Well, my last piece then is, I feel like this is even getting kind of trivialized into like this duality of like intellectualism versus emotionality, which is fine. Like both exist, like you said, which I completely agree with. But that kind of even trivializes like the issue of rape. So now we're getting kind of stuck on semantics and like kind of like it feels like it would turn into an argument of like statistics versus what's real and what's not. And we're kind of missing this huge picture of like people being raped. And I feel like that's where these conversations go. And that's not what I was prepared for. And that's what I don't want to get caught in, is kind of like wrestling with who's right. And we get so caught in being like right that we're missing.
How does that trivialize someone's experience to talk about it at a high level? How are we supposed to make
decisions? Well, hold on. Because a part of, hold on for a second. I think part of what I'd ask Lincoln, and I maybe say this to Tarif, and I think you've already sort of answered this in terms of we can struggle and figure out how to get at some of these, how to do this better, right? And I appreciate your willingness, Lincoln, to be like, okay, yeah, we need to figure out how to do this better, right? So I appreciate your willingness to stand in the circle or sort of, you know, to lean in. So Tarif, I'll also ask you, can you acknowledge the necessity for finding a way to engage in these conversations and do this thing in a way that makes people, not just about making people feel comfortable, but honors people's experiences and doesn't make people feel like it's being trivialized, even if you don't even think it's being trivialized? I think you understanding whether or not that's being trivialized comes along later, right? But whether or not, does this make sense, I guess, what I'm asking?
Yeah, and I think to answer your question, I'm always willing to be part of the conversation, and I am always at least going to try to understand those experiences that people have been that people have gone through. So yes, I do have that capacity. That doesn't mean I'm going to allow that to dominate the perspective I bring to the table. I think that that still needs to stand, and that's why I participate in these things, even though it often, you know, puts me on one end of the spectrum versus the rest of the group.
For sure. For sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's a one side versus the other here.
Yeah.
I do think what's inherently difficult is that we're, DJ, you're asking for the answer to a question about something that is happening in real time. As in, like, you're asking, it's weird because it's like this weird, like, you look at yourself in the mirror and you see all the, like, faces behind you. Or I don't know what that's called. But essentially what you're saying is, like, you're asking us to answer questions about something we're doing as we talk to one another. And that's just inherently difficult because it's just this weird. The issue is happening, and you're asking us to ask what is happening, right? And that's inherently difficult because we have to do it. We have to play this out to answer your question, right? I think, and that's just me thinking, like, we're trying to take a step back and seeing why there's a difficulty here is because this is not as easy as being like, what's one plus one? It's like this weird metaphysical thing you're asking us to do in real time as time is progressing. You know, like, I don't know. This sounds crazy.
Yeah.
It really, truly does. But
it's
hard to say, like,
what's going on in my head all the time. So now you can empathize.
Okay. there's no way I can make a statement about politics today without pulling from my personal experience as a Black woman. I cannot separate the two, right? Like, I cannot say this administration is fucked up without thinking, well, to be fair, it's been fucked up for most Black women for all of time, right? You see what I'm saying? So it's like,
yeah.
We can't have those conversations without having Tarif's or Lincoln's perspectives clashing. They have to inherently clash for us to find the answer. So in a way, preventing the clash is preventing the solution to the extent that we can keep it civil, if that makes sense to Tarif or Lincoln in the context of this, because I'm not necessarily trying to find a common ground. I am trying to explain what I find to be a very, very cool interplay of real time and, like, ideology. It's pretty fascinating, but I don't necessarily think we get over this hurdle by avoiding it.
That spot on. That was perfectly
for sure.
Said.
Okay.
For sure.
And it doesn't have to happen today. There's not enough time in the rest of March 8th to do that. But just as the concept itself is something I think. I wish we could get everyone on the phone to talk about that together, but without the clash, and I hate to give Sam Huntington any credit for anything because I hate him, but, like, without this clash of opinion, without this clash of thought and perspective and lived experience, we cannot answer your question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We won't even get close. And I think what all of the politics that is happening today is us trying to avoid the clash.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the world, like, the only reason we progress is because we survive the clash of perspective.
right? Like, I think there are ways to mediate that clash so that everyone feels respected. That's what I would like. I would hope for in these conversations, because I never want to get to a point where someone feels disrespected. But up until the point where we can stay respectful, the clash has to happen for progress. And to answer your question, DJ.
I like it. I think that's a good place for me to ruminate on or leave off on. I'm unless anybody has anything else to say, but that's a good, I think that's a good place. Y'all, I don't know if it's just that I'm nerding out, but this makes me very happy. That happy is not the word, joyful. I'm joyful that y'all are willing to sort of engage and do this, you know, outside of your like daily lives, you know, and hopefully some of it's taken into your daily lives, you know. So yeah, that, I'm just very thankful. So I appreciate all of you, and that's what I got. So thank you. So have a good night.
For this, I don't know who's up next, but DJ, I know you'll keep us up to date on this.
Alessandria is next.
All righty.
So that'll be fun. All right. Good night, friends.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night. Bye.